Hello, sir. Welcome to the Jim Stroud Show. If you would, please tell us who you are and what you do.
Well, my name is Ralph Baer. I'm retired, is I guess the direct answer to what I do. But beyond that, I write books, I play in bridge tournaments, I run races, and I'm really enjoying life. In terms of background, I worked in the Department of Energy. I worked in the Department of Treasury. I was a naval officer. I worked with McKinsey and Company, which is a international management consulting firm, and maybe some other small things.
Okay. Living your best life is what I hear here and there. Now I know you've written at least one book, I think a couple of books, if I have my notes correct. And your latest book is, and correct me if I'm wrong, Liberty, Science, and Wealth, The Evolution to Modern Society.
Here it is.
There it is. All
Yep.
right. Very cool. What inspired you to write that?
Frustration
Okay.
in that there were some questions about how the world works that were making no sense to me, particularly the enduring and vexing question that has been addressed by many people of why some countries prosper and other ones don't, when it seems like everyone has the capability. That at a first level has been answered and been addressed by many people in the world, but not conclusively. And I thought it was worth digging in at a deeper level, which is something I think I've done. And I think I've developed an unconventional way of looking at the question and the problem. I hasten to add, not something that is totally original with me, but I think the way I have taken the work of other people and connected the dots is fairly original and has great explanatory value.
Now, based on the topics in your book, it seems obvious to me that you feel that the government is rather intrusive these days. How do you think the intrusion of the government on our freedoms is putting our freedoms at risk?
Well, it's putting our freedoms at risk, plus it is slowing down the economy. I'm not quite sure where to begin with all that. I have a laundry list of ways which I think that's inappropriate. And if you'd let me back up perhaps just for a minute.
Please.
When I say the question of countries prospering has been well addressed in some ways, I'm thinking particularly of studies that have reports every year, like the Index of Economic Freedom, which is put out by Dow Jones and the Heritage Foundation everywhere, every year. But there are other studies too, like the Freedom of the World. And they have identified roughly 10 measurements, 10 metrics on which to view the function of government, and virtually every one of them is associated with freedom, as you mentioned it. And the more intrusive the government is, and the more they trample on freedom in terms of the free working of the economy, as opposed to what you were suggesting, our freedom as individuals, the more they slow down, the more they make us less prosperous than we could be, and the more they endanger our future. Just in a nutshell.
Sure, that's interesting. So the less free we are as a people, the less prosperous the country becomes.
Yes, if you'll indulge me perhaps with a little bit of
Please.
abstraction here.
Okay.
Going back to what I said before, I think the question has been well addressed. Countries that match the metrics of the Index of Economic Freedom virtually all prosper. So the question is, why are the other countries not doing what is, to me, perfectly obvious and what is obvious to most analysts, I would argue. And my particular take on the question is that it's a cultural and a sociological question. that if you look at how societies function, and I'll get back to that in a second, to prosper, you have to maximize the freedom of the individual, but in addition, you have to maximize something I would call social capital, which is the way the individual is able to function within society, make the most of his talents, and contribute the most to the existing institutions within society. And the government has a role to protect that, but our government has become so intrusive and so smothering that it's seriously affecting our ability to function in that regard. Let me go back a couple of hundred years to Adam Smith. He said very clearly, all that is required for society to prosper is for a light hand of government. That government should not be a nanny state. It should not try to organize the private sector. That people are pretty good at determining what their needs are and how they want to approach that. Yes, important role for government in the area of keeping us safe, keeping us secure, reducing fraud, increasing transparency, and so on. But they should not be intrusive in how the economy works and what we're allowed to do as individuals within that economy.
What do you think the motivation is for the government to do the things it's doing to intrude on our freedoms? Is it just a matter of a few individuals wanting more power? Is it really just about money and power?
I wouldn't say it's just about that. I certainly subscribe to that. The economist Deepak Lal said that everywhere in every culture, government has a tendency to depression, of wanting to be predatory and to increase their own power. Every living entity is always trying to increase their own power. So that's part of the motivation. But I'm willing to concede that many people in government are acting out of good intentions, that they think they have a better view of how we should lead our lives than perhaps we're doing. And they are constantly intrusive. And I make an argument in my book that what we have is an ongoing tension between ungrounded sentimentality on one part and empirical reality based on experience on the other. And I'm clearly in the empirical reality camp.
I hear you. I think because of that, we have such a struggle enacting term limits. It's amazing to me how so many politicians can get elected and they stay in office for seemingly forever, getting richer and richer. And no one seems to call them on obvious corruption. What do you think?
And there's no accountability for bad results. We have horrible results for so long. But I guess there are two responses to that. The first is, that's nothing new. That issue was confronting our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention. Madison was perfectly aware of that. If you're going to have a free society, which I think is essential, and given the fact that it is so difficult to get the truth out there, and there's a lack of substantive accountability on specific issues, that ultimately, as Madison said, it's got to be up to the electorate to hold these people accountable. And we do that at least every 2 years in terms of elections in the country. And that being said, I sometimes am discouraged by how many things gain currency that simply aren't true. On the other hand, I'm immensely encouraged by the wisdom of the people, that given enough time, the people see through this and they enact new courses and new course corrections at election times.
Yeah, and I can share some of your enthusiasm for the public waking up to a lot of things. But it seems that the public takes a long time to wake up. And I don't know if it's a matter of people just have a life, so they're not keeping up with what's going on. I don't know if it's a matter of a lot of the bread and circuses that are presented to the country through the media and other distractions that are going on. Do you think it is both or either, that people aren't fully awake to what's going on? Is it because they have a life, or is it because they're constantly distracted by the media and whatever the most recent outrage is at the time?
I think both of those things certainly are true, but I don't think that it is enough to fully capture the dynamic in a democratic society. But certainly it's true, we all have lives to live. Probably few of us have the expertise to really parse the news and the spin that we're constantly being exposed to. So it's got to be a reaction of the people to fundamental trends that are affecting their long-term livelihoods. And as we see time and again, when the government makes a hash of the economy, when we go into economic downspins, the party in power almost always gets evicted. And right now we're seeing how quickly the electorate is responding to growing inflation levels in the country.
Most definitely, most definitely. In your book, let me quote this correctly here. In your book, you mentioned, quote, central argument is that man's discovery of ways to successfully cooperate with his fellow man on community, national, and global scales in the face of ubiquitous predatory instincts is his greatest achievement and foundation for all advanced civilizations, end quote. Do you think that we are losing the ability to successfully cooperate with one another in America?
Well, I see a lot of forces on the left heading in that direction. The more they try to prevent free speech, for example, all this political correctness on campus, they're trying to shut down debates, can be a serious danger in that. But I think as long as we have free speech in the country and free elections, we'll be able to keep that under control. I think one of the more interesting themes in the book that you just touched on is what I consider to be a momentous societal evolution over the last 1,000 years, where particularly Western societies have developed the institution and governmental mechanisms to keep predation under control and to allow the free economy to prosper. That's always in danger. And if I can, I'm going to refer to another book that I've published in the last 2 years. I'm showing that here too. It's called Eternal Vigilance, Guarding Against the Predatory State.
Wow, good title.
And so the first book we referred to, I tried to provide the theoretical foundations for how we've reached at this point and how we've laid in the important values and institutions. The second book more or less looks at the last 100 years of how those values that our founding fathers gave us have been under attack by the progressive left. The specifics how that occurs, what the costs are for that, a little bit what might be done about it going forward. But I'm only mentioning that right now to get to your prior question. So this is the problems we're having is not unique or are not unique to the United States. But if you take a look at other representative democracies around the world, you've seen very similar patterns. And in my book, I take a look at, say, Sweden and New Zealand, Chile, as examples. All of them started doing many of the economically dysfunctional things we're increasingly doing today. They all hit financial brick walls where it was simply impossible for them to go forward. They couldn't borrow money in the world. They had high inflation. Their economies were cratering. But they were, with an exception maybe of Chile for right now, democratic societies. They turned around on a dime in both of those. Once they saw the system wasn't working, they put in massive reforms that had very promising performance afterwards. And I'm a believer that we're capable of that too.
So much has changed since the Biden administration took over. And it's discouraging to left and right, I think, to see such things as inflation, as you mentioned earlier, rising gas prices and all that kind of thing. And we're only in, what, a year and a half maybe into the administration.
Right.
The way things are progressing, by the time there is another presidential election, would it be too late to turn things around on a dime if we've learned from our lessons from other countries?
No,
I was hoping for an optimistic answer there.
I don't want to be too Pollyannish about this.
Okay.
I personally think we're probably going to have a terrible financial crisis, and a lot of people are going to suffer. But your question really is, are we able to turn it around? And right. The answer to that is, we are fundamentally a very rich country. And we haven't yet gotten into other aspects of the answer, how society functions. But society, our wealth is more than the stock market. Our wealth is more than mineral wealth. Our wealth is very much a societal wealth and an individual human wealth. There is an absolutely marvelous study of a few years ago from the World Bank, which asks the question, where is the wealth of nations? And for all the major countries, they take a look at mineral wealth and all the capital investment that we have and the like. But they come up with the conclusion that something like, for advanced countries, 80% of the wealth is in what is called a societal wealth or investment within an economy. And that remains. That is pretty much the smarts of the people, the educational levels, the experience they bring to bear, all of our heritage or cultural heritage economically, and that can snap back in a hurry. Now, this isn't a great parallel, but let me throw it in anyway. You might tell from my age that I guess you could say, fortune of visiting Germany in 1949, right after the Second World War. And the German cities still lay in ruins. So to the eye, you would say that Germany was a totally ruined country. Certainly their stock market was pretty much in the tank. The Reichsmark wasn't worth anything anymore. But I went back 5 years later on another trip. I couldn't find rubble anywhere. They were in the midst of what was known in German as the Wirtschaftswunder, or the economic miracle. And they just grew like blazes for the next 20 or 30 years, and very quickly had regained the lost wealth that they had lost through the Second World War. My argument in that, and I'm probably not alone in that, is they had the societal wealth in terms of their human capital and their prior history in the use of social capital to rebuild very quickly and to regain that wealth. And I don't think there's any prospect of us having the destruction and the loss that Germany had. So I think even if we have major financial correction in this country or another crisis like the Great Depression, with the right policies, we can turn around very, very quickly.
That's very encouraging to hear. But I think it also crosses over another topic in your book. You mentioned the word predation. And what it seems like to me is the government extracting a lot of money from the people to benefit the elite. Talk a little bit more about predation, if you would, from your book, and tell me if I'm right. Am I understanding you correctly from your book that the government seems to be taking money from the citizens to benefit the elite instead of everyone? I mean, would you agree with that?
I think so. I might have a broader definition of elite than you do. A lot of the money is simply to buy votes, and that money ends up going, say, to poorer people, not just the elite. A lot of the money, if you include special interests and crony capitalism in the elite, that is certainly true. But I think it is taken from the economy in dysfunctional ways that cost everybody going forward. Let me, again, at the risk of getting into too much detail, I'm a very strong believer in small government because I don't think government uses money all that wisely. I think the way we've constructed, for example, Social Security or Medicare and others is very poorly done and costs us severely compared to other countries that do this kind of thing much better than we do. But I refer in the book to a number of studies along those lines. There's something called the Ron curve, which was developed by the economist Richard Ron, that shows that once the government takes a cumulative tax take greater than 20% of GDP, they more and more slow down the economy because the government isn't as good at spending the money as individuals are in spending the money. And there are all sorts of studies like looking at all the advanced countries in the world that show over a 30, 40 year period as the countries take the GDP marches up from 20% to say 40 or 50%, which many countries do, their growth rate slows down markedly. And you know, that's a pretty clear pattern. And so I'm a great believer in keeping the government in a box. They simply, in their desire for greater power, to buy votes with other people's money, they can't be trusted. And that's a pretty blunt statement. And to a certain extent, we were very lucky but at the time of the Constitution, when the country was founded. In my view, the Constitution was created for very narrow purposes, that it was pretty clear that the 13 states could not function under the Articles of Confederation. They had no good way of coordinating. They had no source of income. There was no one leader. It was very difficult to confront the rest of the world in matters of trade or international politics. So they felt something had to be done. But most of the states didn't trust one another, and for good reason. That's the nature whenever you have multiple political entities. But in our case, many of the states were free riders during the Constitution, didn't pay their way, didn't contribute their troops. Plus, the North was very much a trading set of states. You had the agricultural, and then, of course, you had the whole business, horrible business of slavery in the South. And there was just, and the small states didn't trust the big ones. That's something like just Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and New York had were much bigger, had greater populations than all the smaller states. So they weren't willing to give up their power to the others unless there were strong safeguards. And that is the prime reason, if you take a look at the Constitution, for the enumerated powers. The Constitution clearly says we're only going to give the federal government certain powers. These are powers in terms of making sure of a sound currency, in terms of trade policy, in terms of defense policy and the like. And clearly in the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, they say everything else belongs to the people and to the states, and the federal government should not be doing anything beyond that. And to a certain extent, the Constitution was enacted, it looked as though it could, it didn't yet have those amendments, that the government might end up grabbing power, as all governments do, that would endanger the liberties of the people. And as you probably know, they were ratifying conventions in every one of the 13 states. And you needed at least 9 of them to ratify the Constitution. And those were very real debates. There was no rubber stamping this new Constitution. Every one of those 13 conventions, that was the first concern of the people and the delegates there of, are we giving up too much power to the central government? How can we be reassured that will not happen? And Madison in particular and Hamilton went to all those conventions, reassured them to say the government will not overstep those bonds. And that was at that point that Madison promised all the states, we will immediately enact amendments to the Constitution to ensure you the government will not go there. And that's why the Ninth and Tenth Amendments were enacted at that time. And fortunately, that was pretty much our form of government until the New Deal. And that's why this country prospered to the extent that it did.
Very well explained. And I appreciate that. When we get back, we're going to pause for just a moment for commercial break. But when we get back, I want to continue to talk about constitutional powers and how we have different branches who supposedly are limited in the powers that they exert. But then you have executive orders and you have legislation from the judicial bench and other things like that, which seems to supersede their constitutional powers. I want to ask you about that when we get back after this moment, after this commercial break.
Sounds good to me.
The Jim Strauss Show will return after these messages. This episode of The Jim Strauss Show brought to you by Conservative Television of America, working hard to stick socialism where the sun don't shine. Conservative Television of America is now available on Fire TV Stick, Roku, and on the Conservative Television of America website. Tune in now at www.ctva.tv. Conservative Television of America, we say what you're thinking. The Jim Strauss Show is back. Thanks for watching.
And we're back. And we were just talking about constitutional powers and how we're supposedly under our Constitution, every branch has sort of limited powers that they could exert, sort of a check and balance system. But nowadays, it seems like that's a bit of a gray area. I look at things now that presidents have done, not just the present day president, but others, where they seem to just rule by fiat, executive order, like some kind of monarchy. And I'm going to have an executive order and no need to discuss it in Congress. We're just going to make it done. We're going to call it a mandate. Mandate's not a law, but it doesn't matter. I still want you to obey it. What would our founding fathers have said about some of the executive orders that are being exerted recently?
Well, I think they'd be appalled, and rightly so, that in the current circumstance, it's Congress's role to put them back in the box. That if you look at the Constitution, that essentially it's the president rules over the executive branch, and it's his role to execute the laws passed by Congress. And if you don't have congressional authority for these executive orders, in my mind, they're illegitimate. But if Congress doesn't step up to it, and if the Supreme Court doesn't overrule it, then you have a dereliction of duty, and you start running into the problems that we have today. I argue in my book that, well, I'm a great believer in competition. I think everything in the economy to work smoothly requires competition. For government to work properly, you need competition among the branches. And that clearly was the idea of the checks and balances between Congress, the Supreme Court, and the executive branch. And the implication of your question, and I fully agree, is that has really fallen to the side in the last few years. I trace a lot of it back to the Supreme Court. That until the New Deal, the Supreme Court would slap down that sort of overreaching by the executive branch. It would slap down legislation from the Congress that went beyond the enumerated powers. By 1937, the Supreme Court, when they were threatened with being packed by Roosevelt, they stopped challenging that. And after that, there was very little to restrain the government in terms of things they were doing, whether they were part of the enumerated powers or not. And that has led to so many of the problems that we're experiencing today.
Sure, sure. Do you think that unless there is a drastic change that we're going to have, some would argue that we're already existing under a dictatorship in a sense, not just because of executive orders, but because you also have the social power of cancellation and you have the influence of big tech. So it's sort of like we're operating under a dictatorship to an extent because of outside powers, not necessarily constitutional powers. Is that far-fetched? That's how it seems to me. Does it seem that way to you at times?
I don't think so. I haven't reached that stage of being alarmed. I think there's nothing that doesn't go to excess sooner or later. I think there are a lot of reactions, say, to big tech, of competing elements coming to power. I think there are other sources of information in society. And again, I go to the wisdom of the people. And let's take one of my hobby horses. I don't know whether you would agree with it or not. I have very little sympathy for all of the alarm that's going on right now, global warming or climate change. I simply think it is not the problem being made out, that the left is riding that as a hobby horse to gain more power in legislation. And here's where I'm encouraged. I mean, the media is bought in almost entirely to it. There's a drumbeat that goes on incessantly. But if you look at every poll taken of the American people for years now, the problem of global warming is at the very bottom. They are simply not buying it. And I'm encouraged by that. They shouldn't be buying it. It's a non-issue, and it's a dangerous issue the way this administration has been playing it. And I think people have that kind of wisdom in other areas too. But you led into that question with the whole idea of whether or not we'll have some sort of financial collapse or so. I think that may well be. I'm not ruling out the idea of a collapse, say, in the order that preceded the Great Depression. Unfortunately, the Republicans were in charge of that. They did a lot of things wrong that led to that stock market crash. But then the Democrats colluded with that and then made everything worse under the New Deal. Nevertheless, it was that financial collapse that gave the Democrats a huge majority in Congress and the ability to ride roughshod over our traditions financially. I guess I'm right now thinking the people are wise enough that if there is another crisis, that there'll be enough majorities in Congress, plus presumably a Republican president, to put through major reforms. So that would be what I would hope going forward.
Yeah, I would hope so too. We've weathered the storms of recessions before. The Great Depression, closer to my lifetime, the 70s, we had a recession then under Carter. It seems like the trend is we're going to go beyond Carter recession levels at this point. Hopefully that won't happen, but if it does, what are some things we've done in the past to help us get past recessions? So hopefully we can just repeat what we've done in the past to fix our present day issues.
Well, let me break that down into two things. First of all, you have to break the back of inflation, have a sound currency. And to that, I think we need to pay a great tribute to supply side economics and what was called Reaganomics at the time. That took the stagflation, it subdued stagflation, a falling stock market, and turned the economy around. And then, of course, we need to cut spending. And in that regard, and we haven't really touched on it right now, another contributor to a possible crisis in the future are unfunded entitlements. That, as I said earlier, our whole structure of Social Security and Medicare is outrageously cumbersome and totally uneconomic. I've seen from the Cato Institute, for example, idea we might have $75 trillion worth of unfunded entitlements going forward. And I think we simply are unable to meet our promises to the American people in the area of Social Security payments or to Medicare.
And excuse me, sir, did you say $75 trillion?
I did say $75 trillion, on top of an existing $20 trillion of national debt that we have right now. The whole system is getting to be out of control, and that's what's going to lead to a crisis of one kind or another.
Wow.
Now, having said that, the solutions to something like Social Security and Medicare are pretty obvious, and I'll come to that in just a second. But as you're probably aware, if anyone who's followed political debates in the last few decades, Social Security is considered to be the third rail of American politics. No one wants to touch it because it is so popular with the American people. And you can understand that. So many people's livelihoods are tied up with Social Security and they don't want that touched. And I understand that. But there'll come a time when the promises can't be met that something will have to be done. And what might that something be like? And I go back again to my books, particularly the second book, Eternal Vigilance. Other countries in the world have done this so much better than we have done. And I look particularly right now at three examples. I look at Germany, I look at Switzerland, and I look at Singapore, for example. And let's roll the clock back, let's say 100 years or 120 years. All advanced countries had populations that were worried about old age and the need for pensions or the need for health care. Well, what does one usually do when one has worries like that? One buys insurance because you might need it or you might not need it, but you don't want to take the chance of not having it. And if you look at all the United States and the country, not Singapore, but the other countries, civil society, as you would expect, a free civil society would work that problem on its own. Populations had extensive ways of buying insurance on the private market to meet those needs. Now, that didn't include everyone, but going back to how do you do that better, the way you do that better is how Germany and Switzerland did it. They simply said, people need that. Everyone is obliged to buy their own insurance in those areas. And obviously the poor can't do that. So the government is only going to get involved in this to the extent they will subsidize the poor to be sure they're also insured. But people buy this these policies in the free market on competing plans. And if you go to Germany, you go to Switzerland, there are no unfunded entitlements. They're all actuarially sound. And particularly in terms of medical care, in the United States, we spend 17% of the GDP, 17% on health care. That is an enormous figure. Well, how about Switzerland and Germany? 11%. Two-thirds of what we spend, they have the same health outcomes that we do. And if you want to get more extreme, go to Singapore. Singapore spends 6% and has the same health outcomes that we do. Though they take a somewhat different approach than Switzerland and Germany, but it's an insurance program. There's something called a central provident fund. Everybody is obliged to contribute to that. And from that, they can direct their own personally owned funds into various pension plans, various health plans, can even use some money towards buying a home and the like. And that, of course, is actuarially sound also. And as I said before, only 6% of the GDP ends up being spent, and they have healthcare as good as our own. So that's just an example of how mismanaged our system is, but it also shows the size of the opportunity going forward for reforming our system financially.
Who benefits from these lopsided budgets? Is it special interest groups? I mean, at some point I have to wonder, sometimes it's incompetence and sometimes it's willful incompetence because someone is benefiting. Who benefits from us not meeting our budgetary commitments?
I think it's simply vote buying in this case. People will not do that. Franklin Roosevelt, when he set up Social Security, when it was enacted, he said to his advisors, we have that in place and no politician in the future is ever going to mess with the system. He saw how popular it would be and how entrenched it would become. And time and again over the years, you have Congress enacting higher and higher benefits because it bought votes, even though the money wasn't there in the long run to pay for it, which is why we have the funded entitlements today. So I think it's mostly a vote buying problem. If you go into Medicare and Medicaid, it's also a vote buying problem. But there, I think you're seeing real problems with fraud and abuse. All the studies I've shown indicate that there's tremendous fraud and wastage in monies in our healthcare system, which accounts for the high 17%. Well, I guess that is as far as I can go on that right now.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. One more question for you, because we're running low on time. Time is flying by here. There is much speculation, much prediction, and it's pretty much conventional wisdom that when the elections midterms come through, it's going to be a red wave, and it's going to just supposedly sweep out a lot of Democrats, and Republicans will rise up to power. And I think a lot of people are looking at that as the quick fix for so many things going wrong in this country. Do you think that that will be the case, that all the hopes and all the hope that so many people are having in the Republican Party, that they're going to be like the magic wand to fix everything? Or do you think it's more viable to maybe push for a third party, like maybe the Libertarians, to come to power in the vacuum that may be left when the Democrats are out of power? Does that make sense, what I'm asking?
Well, it makes sense, but it's a huge question. I've got many feelings on the subject. One is I'm not a believer in magic wands.
Me either.
So and my own hope is that, yes, you're right, that the Republicans will sweep the power in the midterms, but that can only give us a stalemate for another 2 years. I mean, Biden will check that. I mean, that's the strength of the presidency. So we're going to need also a Republican president in 24 to go along with the strong legislature, but you're going to have strong majorities in the legislature even for that to work. So that gets to the second part of your question, a third party. Personally, I am a libertarian. I've always been a libertarian, but I don't vote libertarian because I feel that you've got to vote where you've got a realistic choice. And I usually end up voting Republican as a result. But I have ties to the Tea Party, for example, in Northern Virginia. I'm very sympathetic to that. And so the question is, where might that go? The Tea Party arose at a alarm, and this is already more than a decade ago, of where spending was going in this country. They could see the problems. They could also see the Republicans had not been very effective in the past in dealing with that.
Right.
But, you know, we have a long history in this country of third parties raising their heads when the majority parties aren't doing their job and meeting the real needs of the American people. And we don't have a great track record. The only good track record, I think, is the birth of the Republican Party in the late 50s. Neither the Democrats nor the Whigs were dealing effectively with slavery, and that was increasingly intolerable to the American people. The Republicans arose as the party to deal with that. They squeaked it. I mean, that was a real squeaker in 1860, but they managed it, and the problem was solved. If you go then onward, there was a rise of 30 potential third parties in the 1890s, wanting to confront many of the economic problems in the country. But then essentially the majority parties would adopt the most attractive elements of their programs and manage to stay in power as they then siphon votes away from those 30 third party people. One might hope right now is, well, you can take a look, maybe not a good parallel, say with the French elections, the last presidential election. Mm-hmm. Macron came out of nowhere. He was neither a socialist nor a rightist, but the people were fed up with the major parties and swept him in along with the members of their parliament. So the question is, how might that happen? I can see the American people being fed up with this and growing alarm that the real problems are not being addressed. I would like to think, I personally think the Democrats have been brain dead for 30 years. I mean, they are simply playing on fears of the American people. They're trying to divide us by class and by race and by other things. All of this has no substance to it whatsoever. I could easily see them as part of this wave being swept out. But if they're not, and the Republicans don't rise to the occasion, I can see some other party stealing votes from both of them eventually. The people are going to want these problems addressed and settled.
Yeah, I think there's a big hope that we're going to have a resurgence of the Contract with America, that deal that Newt Gingrich did when he was the speaker, and how they created this long action plan and got things done. And I think people want to see more of that. And if they, it's almost like people are looking at, okay, who's the lesser of the evils? I think a lot of people are thinking that way.
Yeah. As long as these elections are on just hot buttons and peripheral issues, we're not going to settle anything. I think the parties have to be very clear as how they want to address the coming issues in the country. And I think the Contract for America served a good purpose. And as much as I tend to the Republicans rather than Clintons, you have to admit, at the end of the Clinton administration, we had zero deficit. That was remarkable.
That's true.
Yeah.
Now, you think it's because of the balance, though? I mean, I don't want to take away credit from Clinton if that's, you know, his accomplishment, but you had a Democrat president and you had a majority of Republicans in the Congress.
Well, that's right.
It was the
Republican Congress put an end to spending. Without the end to spending, you couldn't have had that surplus. And I'll have to give Clinton credit that in his triangulation, as he called it, he was willing to work with that for the benefit of the country. And part of that surplus went to the fact that Clinton went along with capital tax cuts, the capital gains, and that had an enormously positive effect on the growth of the economy throughout much higher tax revenues, which led to those surpluses.
You know, ironically enough, in today's society, that would make him a conservative.
Very true. Yeah,
that's really, really wild. Yes. Ralph Baer, thank you so much for your time. I've enjoyed it. Thank you for your service. I should have said it at the beginning, but I'll say it now. Thank you for your service. If someone wanted more information about you and about the books you write, how could they find you online?
Well, I have a website. Just go to www.ralphbaer and you'll find me online. You'll find all of my books. There are four books listed in total. Some of my books have been fortunate in winning awards. There are some great reviews the books have gotten, but specifically Eternal Vigilance is the one doing best. Right now, it has won 6 awards as being the best award of the year in politics. But best yet, in terms of the Original Creators Award, it was voted the best nonfiction book of 2021-22 and the best book in politics and philosophy. So all of that is mentioned on my website if you can't find it elsewhere.
Very good. It's not bragging if it's true. Congratulations to you, sir.
I tried to get the word out. And if I have one more second, what we've not been able to cover, which I think is one of the greatest achievements of my book in an intellectual sense, is it's a book of the last 1,000 years in how the values and the institutions that led to the adoption of our cultural heritage and our constitution of this country came about. It's a fascinating story. It's not all that abstract. I put a lot of engaging examples, historical examples. And the reason I bring that up is that's why countries prosper, the ones that have gone through that evolutionary process. The other countries in the world that don't do things right have not gone that evolutionary road and lag behind us. And that's something that I have to do some catching up on.
So much food for thought. I really appreciate it. Thank you again for being on the Jim Stroud Show.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Well, my time is up. I thank you for yours. I'll see you again real soon right here with a brand new episode. So until next time, I love you, America.